everyone. Welcome to the Good Evening Kitties podcast. Today I'm doing something a little different. I got some information here from some old stuff about Tales from the Crypt that I got and got permission to use, and it's different articles. So far we're almost finished with season 2 right now, so these articles are, they're old issues of Fangoria. One is about season 1 and then the other one's about season 2, and I thought it'd be interesting to kind of talk to about them and read through the articles and just kind of give you guys some information of what was going on when they first were promoting the show and things like that. And I got these articles from CryptTube, and the guy who runs it was kind enough to let me use these articles for this episode. So thank you to CryptTube, and I will leave a link in the show notes if you want to go check out that on YouTube. It's pretty neat. So this part here is, like I said, it was Fangoria magazine, and it's promoting season 1. And so I'm going ahead and just going to read through it and talk about it a little bit. It's basically opening up all the different stuff for the 6 episodes that were in season 1 as kind of a promotion here. And there's some cool pictures, like stills from the show and promo shots. So it starts out here like this. It goes, "Cthud, the decrepit, spavined, and grisly old creep hauls a musty book from a shelf and dustily slams it into a table. Whack! The book opens. Giggling to itself, the shrouded, cruddy figure drags a long, spindly, can that be a finger, down the page and starts reading from the story at hand. Gather around, lunatics, the crypt keeper cackles. Shove the bodies aside and make yourselves miserable here in the Crypt of Terror while I tell you another slime story of murder, retribution, and all the jugular joys of death." Those may not be the exact words that finally open the new anthology series Tales from the Crypt on HBO, but that's certainly the tone the show is going to adopt. Incredibly, for its first production featuring major directors, the cable network has embarked on adaptations of those crazy old classics, the E.C. horror comics. This Fangoria article is from magazine number 84. So if you were wanting to maybe check it out, that's the article number, or the magazine number for the, where you could find this article. "Yeah, sure," you say, "but Amicus did in Tales from the Crypt back in 1972. And though that was okay, it wasn't anything to rise from the grave and smack your moldering lips about, was it? Well, you're right. Right about that movie and about Amicus's follow-up, The Vault of Horror, also known as Tales from the Crypt Part 2, released a year later. But this new Tales from the Crypt promises to be something else altogether. Lucky overseas gorehounds will be able to see it in theaters, while U.S. and Canadian Fango fanatics will have the content to themselves with the television versions, beginning with a 3-part show this month. HBO has hired major pro directors, Johnny Craig's classic All Through the House from Vault of Horror number 35, also adapted in the first Tales from the Crypt movie, is directed by Robert Who Framed Roger Rabbit Zemeckis from a script by Fred Night of the Creeps Decker and stars Mary Ellen Trainer. It's photographed by Dean Cundey, a genuine master who worked for years with John Carpenter. Dig that cat, he's real gone, likely to have a different title on screen," and it didn't. "Directed by Richard the Omen Donner, from a script by Terry Black, stars Joe Guido the Killer Pimp Pantaleano and Robert Wool fresh off Batman. The original story was written by Al Feldstein and gruesomely humorously illustrated by the great Jack Davis. The Man Who Was Death is directed by Walter Hill, one of the best action directors in Hollywood, with films like Streets of Fire, The Warriors, and 48 Hours to his credit. His script, by Robert Renau, is from the Crypt of Terror number 17. Despite the number, this was the very first EC horror comic. Hill was one of the major forces behind flinging Tales from the Crypt dripping across your TV screen. A number of years ago," recalls the bearded Hill, "I was approached with the idea of a 3- or 4-part movie based on the old EC comics. I chose this story, the one I'm doing now, but the movie never got made. David Cronenberg was going to do a story, and John Carpenter was going to do a story, and I was going to do a story. Then Paramount pulled out of the deal and it all kind of fell apart. Hope came from an unusual source. These old comic books, which fetch painfully high prices, have been reprinted by entrepreneur Russ Cochran in huge, beautifully bound box sets. This stimulated Hill's attention a second time. I got very interested by the Russ Cochran reprints," Hill nods. "When the movie didn't get made, I mentioned the whole thing to Joel Silver. Joel acquired the rights, got to HBO, and set it up as a motion picture foreign. EC Comics was really the beginning of Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock's Presents, The Outer Limits. They were the cornerstone of all that stuff. Producer William Tytler feels. There's enthusiasm everywhere for this project. Everyone remembers EC Comics because they're vivid, they're very funny, they're very original, they're very scary. I don't think there's been any anthology that has done such a varied style and tone. but these segments are all unified by superb production values and great directors. Before we go any further, let's just clear those cobwebs of doubt from your head. How can any musty old set of comic books from the early 1950s compete with today's juicy, blood-squirting slasher fests? If that question is in your mind, you haven't seen these comics. These comics are so horrifying that nothing has topped them yet, and in their own time, they became notorious, even investigated by a special committee of the U.S. Senate. Censorship forces caused publisher William M. Gaines to drop his entire color line and concentrate on one title, which still survives today, Mad. Walter Hill is shooting his episode at the abandoned Los Angeles jail, now used entirely as a movie location. Some scuttlebutt claims this was the locale for Carpenter's assault on Precinct 13, but no one seems to be able to confirm that. Whatever, this place is definitely a jail. Now they're talking about the first episode of season one, which is The Man Who Was Death. So it's going to go into The Man Who Was Death here. So here we go. In this Crypt Chronicle, Bill Sadler plays Niles Talbot, a prison executor who loves his job. They say the electric current's so fast that the brain gets cooked just as soon as the switch is pulled. Prisoner don't feel a thing, muses Talbot as he throws the switch on another condemned man. I'd hate to think that's true. In the comic book, the executioner is, as the title says, the man who was death, so popular that states everywhere import him off to their felons. But when not guilty verdicts begin to predominate, the executioner is out of work. In Robert Reneau's version, however, Talbot's home state simply outlaws capital punishment. In both stories, the executioner decides to enact punishment himself and begins killing those he feels deserves to die. Walter Hill is dressed darkly and speaks carefully about his work in general and Tales from the Crypt in particular. Most people call me an action film director, and I once kiddingly said the difference between action movies and horror movies is that in action movies you kill men, in horror movies you kill women or defenseless people. He grins sardonically. This story is certainly an ironic little fable, a fantasy on irony. What really distinguished the EC comics more than the stories that took chances for their times, but that was 35 years ago, was the artwork. They really did put together a terrific collection of graphic artists. I think these Cochrane reprints have given them a whole new life. One common feature of EC horror stories was what has come to be known as the EC comeuppance, as publisher Gaines once put it. We sharpen the pencils sharpen us. A bad guy, or very often woman, does something horrible to someone else, and that someone else, or an heir, or an avenger, does something similar, but even worse to the bad guy. This is very moralistic, ultimately. Hill is asked if his own films reflect this kind of retribution. The director ponders this. I don't really like to talk about the thematics very much. If you have specific feelings, and they were very well worked out within yourself, you wouldn't need to make the movie. You don't want to be rude, but the real answer to, well, what are you saying is, go see the movie. Zemeckis' story deals with a woman alone on Christmas Eve, so now they're moving into season 1, episode 2, which is an all through the house. She's just killed her husband, and her little girl is upstairs asleep. Suddenly, the TV tells her that a woman-killing maniac dressed as Santa Claus is on the prowl in her neighborhood. She can't call the cops. There is that suspicious dead body in the living room, remember? And so has to hastily board up the house when she spots the Santa Claus maniac outside. Needless to add, things that go just as she wants. One of the things that Bob Zemeckis accomplishes so magnificently is the blend of horror, violence, and intense suspense, but never to the point where people are really grossed out, Teetler raves. He brings you right to the edge of true horror, but then makes it funny. We can't interview the Crypt Keeper just yet, mostly because he's only partly cast, as it were. FX champ Kevin Yeager has constructed a audio animatronic figure to play the Crypt Keeper, but no one is admitting yet who the voice of the figure will be. He will be our Alfred Hitchcock, our Rod Sterling, our Alistair Cook, Teetler teases. He'll make you laugh, but you know if you turned your back on him, he could kill you. It's his job to keep us amused and frightened. A week or so later, Fango visits the set of Richard Donner's episode, set in a circus. And so this is moving on to season one, episode 3. Dig that cat, he's real gone. So now we're moving on to this one. Joe Pantoliano plays Ulrich the Undying, who's had a gland from a killed kitty cat transplanted into his body, giving him 9 lives. Before throngs of high-paying customers, Ulrich is killed again and again, keeping careful count and each time coming back to life. The day Fango visits the set, he's being hanged by the neck until dead, 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 right in front of his squeaky voice girlfriend, Kathleen York, and with the compliance of a wisecracking barker, Robert Wool. On the same warehouse-turned soundstage is the staggering, astounding crypt itself, one of the most detailed, outrageous sets this reporter has ever had the great eye-popping pleasure to visit. Up in the corners, in true EC rave-fave Graham Ingle style, tortured faces are worked into the stone. Stones in quotations. Rats and spiders prowl about. Giant statuary slowly melts back in the gnarled corners. This is a crypt's crypt, a tomb's tomb, a fitting home for the crypt keeper. It practically reeks. It's a pleasant set to visit despite its ripe horror, and writer Terry Black, who's also writing all the bumpers for the crypt keeper, is delighted to see it himself. I like horror, allows the tall, amiable Black, but I like it with a humorous edge to it. I like goofy horror. This story seemed like the perfect vehicle. Black is now writing Edgar Rice Burroughs' A Princess of Mars for the new Disney arm Hollywood Films. He's been an EC fan for a long while. When I was a kid, I read them until I was too scared, then put them away, except I was compelled to go back and read more, he smiles. Some are very simple stories with a punch at the end. Adapting Dig That Cat was a question of fitting the whole thing into half an hour. I get to play a corpse in this, he adds with a grin. I was afraid I'd give a lifeless performance. I need to put more color into my role, so I play the part with a certain rigor. To the fading sounds of puns and rim shots, your Fango reporter beats a hasty retreat to catch a quick chat with very friendly director Richard Donner. Donner has secretaries in his office sift through 350 EC stories before they came up with Dig That Cat, He's Real Gone. I fell in love with it, the big voice Donner asserts. I had the opportunity for so many deaths. I'd never done anything like this, though I love killing people. In The Omen, for instance, I did a comic book before Superman, and it worked. I left TV for motion pictures, and the weight was off my chest. But when we realized we could go to HBO and we wouldn't have any restrictions, we decided to do it. There's a lot of freedom here. Donner cut his directorial teeth, as the phrase goes, on the final season of the original Twilight Zone, including the classic Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. I thought I was going to come in here and kick ass, he grins, and teach everyone to do a show like this in 3 days, but it's taking 8, and we're going until 11 or midnight each night, so I've made a fool of myself in front of a lot of people. Bob's a two-person piece, Walter is a one-person piece, and this silly thing I took on is massive. It's a carnival, Donner laughs. It's clear to see that he loves the pressure of the shoot. If this thing sells as a series, he asserts, I'd like to keep these kids, his crew, and do more. He rises to return to his busy set. There are a lot of young directors out there I want to use. There are a lot of bright people who haven't had an opportunity, and if we can get a good focus group, a good story editor and producer, we'll use up 350 stories and go on to original material. These are timeless. And only time will tell whether Donner, Hill, and Zemeckis will tell more tales from the crypt. So that was the end of the article for the season one promo. I like that. Yeah, there's a lot of like neat, fun little parts in there about, you know, getting started with HBO and just how they feel with everything. And I like that they didn't go into all the episodes. They kind of gave you a little teaser on everything, which is kind of nice. So we'll get going here and get into the article on season two. Again, from Fangoria. This is Fangoria magazine number 94. So if you wanted to check that out, that's the number for that. Again, thanks to CryptTube for letting me use this and for posting this in general. This is great. And again, I will put a link in the show notes if you wanted to check out CryptTube. So this one's called Return to the Crypt. We're going into season two. Season two ended up having 18 episodes. So as you can see, it kind of, you know, took off by storm. It started out season one with 6 episodes. And now it's like, you know, this big thing. Everyone loved it. So this one's called Return to the Crypt. It's by Bill Warren, is this article. Again, they have pictures and different quotes and things about it on the magazine article itself. But here we go. You can't keep a good ghoul down, and why would you want to anyway? HBO's initial order of Tales from the Crypt episodes was successful enough that the moldy old corpse is back again, with 18 more reeking yarns ripped from the pages of the classic EC horror comics of the 50s. Producers Joel Silver and William Tetler have hired a new horror horde of named directors and mostly newcomer writers to make a further batch of funny, nasty little stories. Jack, the Hidden Shoulder, is directing Fitting Punishment, set in a funeral home owned by and run for Blacks in Louisiana. When he's asked a standard interview question, what's the value of this kind of story, he responds truthfully and amusingly, it has no value whatsoever. It's fun, and it's sick, and it's entertaining. It gives me a chance to really be infantile, and it's fun to watch. The series has proved so popular that Two-Fisted Tales, mostly adapted from other EC stories, is going into production. The first script, however, is the Frank Darabont original Showdown, which he cheerfully describes as a cross between a Western and a Charles Dickens ghost story. This is being done for Fox Television, so you don't have to pay extra to see these tales. Darabont's script is being directed by Richard Donner. Donner also directed Darabont's Tales from the Crypt episode, The Ventriloquist Dummy, which has a really unusual cast for a horror story, comedians Don Rickles and Bobcat Goldthwait. Darabont shifted around Al Feldstein and Graham Ingalls' original story, first published in Tales from the Crypt No. 28, providing a stronger reason for the protagonist, Goldthwait, to seek out the old ventriloquist, Rickles, and also came up with a more vivid, perfectly EC-ish ending. The teleplay is basically a showdown between aspiring, though rotten, ventriloquist Billy Goldman, played by Goldthwait, and retired great voice thrower Ingalls, played by Rickles, who lives in an isolated mountain cabin, hiding from the mysterious death and fire that ended his career. When Billy tries to get Ingalls to reveal the secrets about Morty, his dummy, he learns far too much. Ingalls is not a ventriloquist at all, and Morty is a living creature. Morty is, in fact, Ingalls' imperfectly formed twin brother, growing out of the end of the old man's wrists. See, I kind of feel like you shouldn't have blown that one. I guess by now, maybe the show's been going on for a little bit, but, I mean, that's a really great part, you know, to not have blown. But anyway, they mentioned that, that's fine. Things go from bad to worse, needless to add. When Fango visits the set, it's the scene immediately following Morty's unveiling, as Ingalls slashes at the terrified Billy with a meat cleaver. Goldthwait scuttles backwards on his feet and hands, dodging the cleaver, swung by Rickles' double. Rickles himself relaxes nearby on the set. Oh, he had a body double for that. Okay. Big, but smaller now, he's been dieting. Dick Donner runs a pretty loose ship. No wonder he's a favorite among actors and crews. He allows special makeup FX artist Greg Canham a great deal of leeway in arranging where the cable-controlled Morty will be placed, allowing it to be run from beneath the cabin floor. Boards are taken up and nailed down again. Donner is friendly enough with visitors on the set, or to the set, but just does not have time for an interview. At lunch, Fango grabs a few words with Don Rickles, joking that Rickles made a horror movie back in 1963, Roger Corman's X, the man with the X-ray eyes, and now is making another 27 years later, so he must be typecast. You got a good memory, says Rickles. That was a long time ago with Ray Milland, and it was fun. I don't think it was as much a horror story as this one is. This is really something unusual, and it's fun to do, too. Rickles, not a ventriloquist himself, is somewhat unusual casting for this role. Dick Donner called me in Las Vegas and said, Don, you gotta play this. When I get a call like that from people of that caliber, I was just champing at the bit, so I was delighted to be asked. Being interviewed, Rickles, a quiet and friendly person, responds in careful, reserved words. On the set, he's a bit more raucous, dropping one-liners everywhere. I work with Donner on only one shoot, Rickles cracks, and from now on I'll have to work in Vegas with the dummy. When Greg Canham adjusts the bizarre little body growing out of Rickles' wrists and causes the actor a little pain, Rickles quips, If you knew what I'm getting paid, you wouldn't do that to me. But now, resting in the sunshine outside the converted noodle factory that Tails used for a soundstage, Rickles makes no jokes. He did read the comics when he was a kid, he says. Sure, I saw them, all those kinds of goofy things. Rickles began as a dramatic actor, watched for the old movie The Rat Race. Rickles excels as the heavy, then switched to comedy. Playing a straight role these days is not common for him. You get an image that's so strong, in my case, the so-called insult comedian. I've been at it so long, and I am at the height of my career with nightclub appearances, that it's hard for producers to think of me along the lines of a dramatic role, especially when you're as identified with aggressive comedy as I am. When a role like this comes along, I'm really delighted about it. He doesn't have to do much puppeteering for Morty, reports Rickles. These guys are terrific at what they do, and they work this electronically. I just have to move my hand to make it look like it's alive. He's also pleased to be working with Goldthwait, whom he'd never met before. He's a darn good actor, Rickles says generously. I had certainly heard of him. We get along great. We kid around a little bit, but this is such an involved story that we don't have time to get into a lot of fooling around. Bobcat Goldthwait has another idea why they haven't been kidding around much. I don't think I'm a really funny person in real life all that much. But it's hard not to be funny on screen because that's all I've ever done. The distinctive young comic reasons. Me and Rickles are both very serious in this. Either it will work or the audience will just sit there waiting for the part where we get funny, which we don't. I'm surprised how well Don and I get along. I really like him a lot. He's really contemporary. Sometimes when I meet some of the older guys, they're really bitter and he's not at all. He's still working. He's still out there. I love to talk to him. He makes me laugh. Goldthwait took the job partly because of Darabont's script. I liked it a lot, he says with quiet enthusiasm. Most of the time you think it's going to be the old ventriloquist story where the dummy's alive or the ventriloquist is schizo, but this one is different. I think the last third will surprise people. However, Goldthwait has no real ambitions to move on to dramatic acting. It doesn't interest me at all that much, he shrugs. I did this because Dick asked me to. I trust him, and I don't trust a lot of directors. Goldthwait started in comedy when he was 15 and plans to continue. After all, he says, only half kidding. I can't do anything else. A tired-looking Greg Canham has been serving several stints in the crypt this season. He was especially pleased with his work on Dead Right, the Howard Deutsch episode starring Jeffrey Tambor and Demi Moore. We took Tambor and made him about 400 pounds with pockmarked skin and big nose, really grotesque looking. Canham notes, it turned out quite nice, even though he had only 5 days to do the whole thing. He's a great actor and it turned out to be a great episode. I heard they're going to open the second season with it. And there's one part in this article here I thought was kind of weird. They have a picture from the episode, season 2, episode 11, Judy, You're Not Yourself Today. They got a picture of the witch, like in her grotesque makeup and everything. And there's a caption on the bottom. I mean, I guess they're joking, but it says, the aptly titled Judy, You're Not Yourself Today illustrates what can happen when a woman forgets to put on her makeup. And I guess it's a joke because of the costume. But I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, that's not how the episode went. It wasn't because she didn't put up her makeup. But I was like, all right. Okay, so on with the article. To create Morty for the ventriloquist dummy, Canham only had 2.5 weeks from start to finish. We're using computers to run the whole system, eyes and mouth, because it has a lot of dialogue, he reveals. It's not enough time, of course, but it's working pretty well considering. I designed it and sculpted it myself. Mitch Devane finished it off. Like almost everyone, the FX wizard loves working with Dick Donner. He's really great, really fast, and knows what he wants, Canham appraises. He's liked everything we designed so far. It would be great to work on a real film with him where we had time. On other episodes, people try to overshoot and cover themselves, but Donner knows exactly what he wants, and it all goes by very fast. He said that whatever we need to do, tell him, and he'll work around it, because he knew we didn't have much time. And I'm trying to help with the character. I want to do a shot of the first time you see Morty. Instead of having him just say words, I want to get some more little character things in it, so it's more of an actor instead of a little prop running around. It's always the time thing with TV, but Donner is trying to accommodate me. A few weeks later, Fango returns to the noodle factory. As before, one of the two stage areas is full of workers banging away on sets going up for the next episode. The air is filled with the smell of sawdust and glue. On the set where Jack Shoulder is filming Fitting Punishment, there are some stages from the current episode not being used at the moment. It's the office of elderly mortician Ezra Thorntonberry, played by Moses Gunn. Genteel, a bit seedy, with cheap old carpeting in the hall and a small laying-out room with a coffin at one end in a stage-like setting. At the end of the hall, stairs lead downward to the other set where filming is now going on. This set, off to the left of the office, hallway, and parlor, is the basement where Ezra prepares bodies for the funeral. Jack Shoulder is directing Gunn, and the young actor playing Ezra's nephew, and another actor, playing a pudgy corpse. Shoulder is a slender, tallish man, balding with a hawk nose and glasses tethered to his neck by an elastic cord. If he was an actor, he'd keep getting cast as high school science teachers, but he's a director, and delighted to talk to Fango. He did Tales, he said, because it sounded like a fun show. I had just finished doing a grown-up feature, and I felt like being infantile again. This feature was By Dawn's Early Light, a political thriller about World War III. It's full of people in uniforms standing in rooms and talking on telephones. It plays like a chase, though. That was a trick to do, but I think I managed it. So here, I just get to make really sick jokes again. As a kid, I would crack jokes at the wrong time and get sent to the principal's office. Here, I'm actually getting paid to crack jokes about very serious subjects. He had let Silver and Taitler know that he was interested in a crypt and was called in on pretty short notice. The original script, which he rewrote with Don Child's play Mancini, was a gothic New England kind of thing. Mancini and Shoulder moved the story to the South. I thought it would be great to have a black mortuary in the South, he reasons. There was a time when no white funeral home would bury a black person, so the blacks had to have their own funeral homes. And those people became highly regarded and associated with the churches, and of course they made a great deal of money. Old Ezra, in Fitting Punishment, is a greedy miser. His nephew comes to live with him, explains Shoulder. He takes the kid in, makes him work, doesn't pay him, gets pissed off at him, and breaks his back with a crowbar, making him a cripple. When he feels the kid's too much of a burden, he kicks him down the flight of stairs. Then he buries him in a coffin which is too small, so he saws his feet off to fit him in. At the end, his nephew comes back on crutches minus his feet, and the feet kick the old man down the stairs. Shoulder is very pleased with this nasty, funny story. While we were watching the dailies, he smiles, we were cracking up. It's really sick. We have Moses Gunn pulling gold teeth out of corpses while his kid's eyes are 3 inches big. Shoulder whips out an article from Spy Magazine about how gold teeth are, quoted, mined from dead bodies, quite delighted to have his darkest suspicions confirmed. On the set, Gunn misquotes the Bible. A penny saved is a penny earned, he says. When his nephew points out that the quote comes from Benjamin Franklin, Gunn swats him upside the head. Don't you contradict me, boy. Gunn embalms the body with water. He doesn't know the difference, he explains. And besides, those chemicals cost money. Using the same kinetic, highly mobile style that enlivened The Hidden, Shoulder keeps both his camera and cast moving while shooting this cable episode. Although he admits, this one's more like an Andante than a Presto. I keep the actors moving and I keep the camera moving. He's pleased with other changes he's made. Like, the kid had this great pair of expensive sneakers. After his uncle cripples him, the old man sells the kid's shoes. Shoulder would be glad to direct another episode. It's pretty much a director's series, he nods. The attitude is that way, and that's why everybody wants to do it. At the time Fango went to press, this was the lineup for the new season. The series co-executive producer Walter Hill returns to direct Cutting Cards, written by May Woods and Hill himself. Fred Decker wrote and directs The Thing from the Grave. Chris Wallace tries his hand with Till Death, written by Jerry Barchillion. David Burton Morris helms Three's the Crowd from a script by Annie Willett and Kim Kettleson. Ross Thomas wrote The Sacrifice, which Richard Little Monsters Greenberg directs. Howard Deutsch, who manned one of the original batch of Crips, returns with Andy Wilkes' script Dead Right. Peter Seaman and Jeffrey Price co-wrote For Crying Out Loud, which Price directs, while Tom Holland co-wrote Four-Sided Triangle with Jim Tugent, but directs it by himself. Rhonda Hines handles Judy You're Not Yourself Today, written by Scott Numerfro. And none other than Arnold Schwarzenegger makes his directorial debut with The Switch, written by Richard Tightrope Tuggle. With so many of these stories being enthusiastically made by named directors, well-known actors, and good writers, it's likely that HBO will tell many more tales from the crypt. And so that's the end of the article there talking about season 2 from magazine number 94 of Fangoria. So I just wanted to kind of let everyone know that I thought it was kind of a neat old, you know, blast from the past kind of article, and hopefully you guys liked it. And again, thanks to CryptTube for letting me use this. And so thanks for listening, guys. Check out all the awesome other reviews I've been doing. I'm heading into the end of season 2, and, you know, it's getting exciting and stuff. Again, thank you for all your support. You can contact me at goodeveningpod@gmail.com. There's also a Facebook page for the Good Evening Kitties podcast. You can like that. If you want to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, that'd be great. And again, thanks for listening.
I just had quite a scare. I actually thought my heart was beating.